This is CliffCentral.com.
Welcome to Global Leadership Platform, Leadership Masterclass. We're excited to be here, multiplying leaders, moving society. That's what we try and do. I'm Adrian Groenewald, and with me, the old man, Louis Groenewald. Father-son combination, believe it or not. Old man, welcome again.
Adrian, looking forward to today's discussion once again.
Yeah, we've got lots of polarity in our country, a lot of interesting things happening, and we have a leader who's driving part of that narrative in the studio today. Our leadership masterclass today with Kali Creel, the CEO of AfriForum. Kali, it's great to have you with us. Thank you.
Yes, Adrian, thank you. It's a pleasure speaking to you.
You know, I haven't been in this. We've been doing so many, recordings in leader offices. I still say welcome to the studio, but we're actually in Kali's office.
Yes.
So we're on his turf, and it's a pleasure to be here. The last time we were here, it was an interview with Harry Nell.
Yes.
You were telling us now he's doing well, he's got his team and busy.
Yes, and of course his first success is the fact that the Rizana Zuma is now going to be prosecuted, which wouldn't have happened if it wasn't for Advocate Nell's intervention.
Yeah, people can easily say, well, that didn't happen, but the purpose is so that prosecution happens. They weren't going to do it, the certificate went out, so it swung back to, okay, we'll prosecute.
Yes, that's always for us the first prize. We said we need to see the NPA doing its job, and we will intervene if they don't. But if the mere fact that Advocate Nell's office exists and that he has the ability to prosecute, if that leads to the NPA changing their mind, as happened in the Duduzane Zuma case, that is for us the first prize, and then we can go on to the next matter.
Excellent. Kali, we are going to get to, if anyone wondering, we are going to get to all those issues that have been in the media of late. This is a leadership show, but you've been in the media a lot, more than usual, perhaps, in the last month or so, I don't know. So we'll get there, but first, being a global leadership platform, we want to talk about leadership. And before we go there, in sort of the first half of the conversation, just your background. You're a teacher in trade, then you studied further, ended up in this part of the world. Just give us your background briefly.
Yes, I'm a Pretoria boy. Since I was a young boy, we've been staying here, moved to a few places, but for short times. But I went to high school in the north of Pretoria. I studied at the University of Pretoria, did a master's in political geography.
What's political geography? You know, political science.
Yeah.
What's the geography element?
Well, I focus specifically what the influence of demographics is on what political models are possible. We know that in terms of the apartheid system did not work, for many reasons, of course, because it infringed on the dignity of people, but also in terms of the demographics. You cannot have a minority controlling an area where there is a majority. So I had a look all over the world, what political solutions there are that are just, that respects everybody's dignity, but also make sure that minorities also have a place under the sun. So I looked at various, at Ethiopia, at Belgium, at Canadian examples. So I believe demographics is actually the driving factor in whatever political solution you need to find.
Okay, interesting. A PhD on the cards?
No. After I studied, I met my wife. She's an educational psychologist. And we now have 5 children and 2 dogs. So they're keeping me busy together with my work at AfriForum. So at this stage,
too much.
I'll maybe one day, if I retire, look at the doctor.
Kali, before we go over to some of the more recent discussion points in our country, let's just get your views on leadership, because you're a leader. You've led AfriForum from the start. It's more than a decade now, starting with no members to hundreds of thousands of members. It's a remarkable movement, Louis, old man. So there's leadership involved, and we want to just quickly get your views on leadership. So the question we in general ask leaders are, what statements best describe an authentic leader to you? Let's discuss your 3 or 4 principles so that we can share it with the world.
Yes, I'm not going to go into a philosophical discussion on this. I think there's many books. There are many books that are written on the issue, and many theories. I will focus specifically on what I learned through experience in the last 12 years since we started AfriForum. For me, the one single principle is that assists a leader is that of a motivational factor that is driven by a cause. And that we always say is our secret weapon. Like any organization, of course, we are not perfect people. Sometimes there's a lot of organizational challenges as you get in all businesses. But our secret weapon is when your staff knows that we are working for a cause that is much bigger than themselves, it actually drives people, and you don't have to micromanage to make sure that people do everything. If they are driven by that cause, they will make sure that there's a lot of energy they put in. They will focus on making a practical difference. They will show endurance. We know if it was easy to run an organization, everybody would have done it successfully. Mm. But if you have that calling, that you have a cause that is bigger than yourself, okay. Then you can overcome many problems because you're not going to take it lying down. You're going to know what I'm going to do in office today is not simply just another job. I'm going to make a difference in the lives of people, going to help to create a future, giving hope. And that is actually our secret weapon, and that we apply from our leadership to make sure that we take our whole team forward.
So, I mean, we hear this a lot, and it's a powerful principle. All you need is for your people that you employ, that work with you, to connect emotionally and intellectually, I guess, with the cause. Mm. And then half the battle is won. Because then they'll work when you're not there. They'll work late hours if they need to. They're driven by self-motivation rather than your motivation.
Yeah.
Because they've connected with a cause. Old man, thoughts on that? I mean, that is a... There's definitely... I mean, in corporate, depends on the leadership environment. Some seem to have a bigger challenge to have a cause because some causes are just money.
Carly, obviously we see hundreds of quality leaders and thought leaders as well. And quite frankly, a trend amongst those we respect the most, those who have certain kind of a fresh passion in what they do, all driven by a cause, of which, by the way, the profitability might be a lesser cause. It's never the main cause to these people as well. They're all driven by a cause. Africa is now generating those kind of leaders, and other leaders are starting to lag behind because people see through them. The body language says they're not really convinced what they're doing is right. So we find people with a genuine motivation, you know, to serve the higher laws or intelligence. It's a good feeling.
Yes, I think if the bottom line is simply making money, you are bound not to make a lot of money. If your bottom line is something bigger, generating capital is something that comes with that passion, and it actually follows the passion.
Yes.
Okay. So a little later on the masterclass, we'll look at the cause of AfriForum and your personal cause in life. Okay. What's the next principle that you describe authentic leadership?
Well, something we do quite strongly is to have confidence in young people to be able to do the job. And if you're going to look at the age of AfriForum staff, the average is around 30 years of age.
That's young, yeah.
So we appoint many people straight out of university, and the most of our staff that we have here, their first job is the job that they have with AfriForum. Why it works for us, I know in many big companies people would say you want a certain amount of experience, but because we're different than a normal company and we have unique challenges, sometimes the experience you get in the corporate world, you have to actually make sure that you get rid of that experience. Mm. Because the challenges we have, for instance, we're doing things like fixing potholes, testing water, starting community safety initiatives, which is many things that the government should actually fund from taxpayers' money. And in our situation, we We're also a big business. He's quite scared of supporting an NGO that sometimes have to take a stance against government. So you have to now think in a way that has never been thought in the past. How are you going to do these functions? How are you going to fund it? And that is something that you, that is not a similar kind of organization. And what we've seen from young people is a lot of energy and creativity. And that has actually helped us to bring about something that has not been seen in Africa before. With our 208,000 members plus, we are the biggest civil rights organization in Africa. And apart from what I mentioned just now, the cause, the second pillar, as I've mentioned now, is the energy that you get from young people, creativity. And of course, my dad, you're lucky to still have your dad here. My dad had passed away. He said he'll rather try and haul in a wild horse than trying to resuscitate a dead horse. And that is sometimes people are scared of young people because they run faster than most people. But our view is rather haul in people and calm them a bit down than trying to get somebody just to get some energy. And that formula works quite well.
And I guess that connects you with the next generation in a natural kind of way, doesn't it?
Yes.
It gives your organization potentially longevity from a pure corporate or organizational point of view if your target and one of your key success factors is the energy of young people. And we all know the youth is our biggest challenge in the country, youth unemployment and so on. That just naturally connects you with that audience. That could be powerful.
Oh, no. I believe, you know, we find in authentic leadership, the term we use, that your mindset is vital, especially in our incredibly changing environment worldwide, but especially in this country. And I imagine if you rely on this younger generation, a lot of the perhaps negative mindsets of the past is far easier to change. Mm-hmm. It's a very important factor because your example of the, you know, the old horse to revive that, it's not all that easy.
Yeah. Maybe if I can just add, normally if you want to appoint somebody, you can have a month-long process screening them, having interviews. But the benefit we have, one of the things is that at a lot of universities, we form AfriForum youth branches, and we also have those branches in 70 towns across the country. And, maybe I shouldn't say this while I'm being recorded, but you have the ability to have a young person actually being involved in a 3 or 4 year long job interview because the involvement in your youth structures, you can see what their abilities are, you can see what the energy levels are. And then, of course, we use that as a pipeline in terms of people coming into the company.
Okay.
And if you look at the 4 deputy CEOs of AfriForum at the moment, 3 of them were people that came through our youth structures. That is very important for us to use that as a pipeline to bring in new energy into the organization. I'm actually one of the eldest people here, working here.
Kali, give us your next principle that describes authentic leadership.
Well, it's actually become a cliche, and you've probably heard it quite a lot, but it still remains true, and that is that you have to surround yourself with the best people. And you have to be able to recognize your own blind spots. So what our mechanism is that we use in terms of the consultants, we use the whole strength finder principle. And then, of course, you don't focus on your, well, they don't speak about weaknesses nowadays. They speak about development areas. But to be quite frank, every person has a number of weaknesses. And the important thing is you can now work very hard, and it will be energy tapping to work on those development areas. But we would rather say focus on your strong points make sure that is utilized. But then in your team, have a variety of people whose abilities can can actually make up for where those gaps are in your own leadership ability.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm fortunate to have in the organization, varying people. We can have debates, think differently on many issues, but those are important. You don't want to have a situation where everybody, in Afrikaans we have a term, jaarbroers. You want to have people that can openly state an alternative view, that can have alternative methods and actually create a team of diverse people, but that can work effectively towards one goal.
Yeah, a lot of leaders would say you must have a strong team around you. You must have a team with members that are better than yourself. But not all leaders do that. In actual fact, when it gets to the point, then they don't like to be feel threatened by more qualified or more dynamic individuals around them. But that's a powerful principle. You have another principle?
Well, maybe it's just something I read. If Jim Collins is well known for his what he wrote about From Good to Great. But what many people will not know is he also wrote a very small book, From Good to Great, in the social sector.
I never knew that, yeah.
Yeah, and what is important in that book, and it guides you in terms of leadership, when we started AfriForum, I actually used the wrong word for it. I said we need to run this like a business, not in a sense, you know, as an NGO and that is a non-profit company. We don't have shareholders and dividends that's being paid out. What you do have is you, in terms of the law, but also in principle, the funds you generate has to be used for your goals. I also always said you still need to be sustainable like any other business. You need to be able to fund what you want to go and do, so you have to generate capital. But what Jim Collins wrote is it's actually not business principles, because you can have certain businesses that don't succeed. So you don't necessarily just want to say all business principles are good.
It's actually organizational principles.
Almost. Yes. Well, he says we should speak the language of greatness to make sure, and that applies to a business for profit, but also a non-profit company such as ourselves. And if you have that, because I think the problem is we see many NGOs failing. It's sometimes being used as an excuse to say, well, because we're an NGO, we actually have to struggle. So it's an excuse for mediocrity. But if you say, well, there's no reason why NGO should not strive toward greatness like any other company. Our dividend is what we achieve, and not what our profit is at the end of the year. Mm. But to achieve, the same applies. You need to have a generate stable income, a predictable income. You need to grow your income, and you have to make sure that you use your resources as effectively to get as much results with what you have, and that has worked for us quite well. And together with that is we have a principle to say we need a plan, but an achievable plan. Mm. It won't help if you go on a daydream and you have these huge plans, but it's not you cannot achieve it practically. So you have to have a plan that is possible to achieve. But then you need the capacity to implement that plan.
Yeah.
And I think that's where the problem is with many NGOs. You have great ideas, but you don't have the capacity to implement it. So we have to focus to build capacity in the organization in terms of leadership, in terms of capital, in terms of having people that are volunteers that support you. Mm. And the combination of a achievable plan and the ability to implement that plan is actually a winning recipe.
I mean, you could have the most amazing cause, honestly, inspirational, and people want to rally behind it. But if you don't have the structures and the resources and often the money to do that, then your cause just dies a slow death. And people very quickly forget that cause.
Yes.
When you can't even pay the bills and you've got no premises. And you're right, a lot of NGOs don't run it like a business or like an organization or speak the language of greatness. Old man, you want to?
Just on the point, the language of greatness, Carly, is something that obviously you would want reflected in everything you do, not just in a kind of the vision and occasional management meetings, but the language of greatness is also the language of honesty, integrity, but also the best out of every possible person. It's a language of drawing the best of everybody around you. That part of people that can move situations in a positive direction. So that language of greatness obviously becomes in a culture within the organization. I assume that's what you mean.
Yes, most definitely. Yeah. And you know what is quite nice for me is the fact as we've grown, we've started off with only 3 staff members and no members that were contributing, no resources. And in the beginning, you were able to keep your finger on everything that happens. But as soon as you know, when we've grown to more than 150 staff members, you have to make sure that you have people that are driven by the strive towards greatness. And what is the nicest for me is if I go to a function that was organized or a project that was organized by some of the staff here where I'm not involved in that project, but you get there and you can actually say, yes, this is brilliant. Mm-hmm. And that gives you confidence. It creates a lot of space where you can focus on strategic issues because you don't have to worry that you have to go now trying to persuade people to do things great. They do it themselves and they do it great. So that gives one a lot of space to focus on what is needed to be focused on.
Kali, those are good principles. I think let's move on. And if we need to come back to some more, then we can do that. You mentioned the cause. So take a moment and describe the cause, the purpose of AfriForum.
Yes.
And I want you to, I hope that this is an interesting angle I'm coming from. Let's say the slate was clean out there and everyone could hear for the first time without baggage what AfriForum is about. What would you say to them? Because I know practically we can't. We're all so infiltrated by perceptions and emotional issues as a country and as a nation. But supposing we're all listening for the first time, what is the purpose and the cause of AfriForum?
Yes, if we had hours, I would have loved that we go through the whole process. But when we were formed, we started a consultation process with many people to set up what we call our Civil Rights Charter, and in Afrikaans, a Burgerrechte Manifest. Both the Afrikaans and English versions are on our website where people can go and look at that. We drew that up 12 years ago, but it still applies today. What that says is that, and AfriForum was initially formed because you had many members of minority communities, especially Afrikaners, that left the country or simply withdrew. And we said, in a vibrant democracy, you need to make sure that everybody participates. And we started with that process to say, Afrikaners as a minority community aren't Europeans. The fact is, they've been here for more than 360 years in this continent. They became indigenized. They called the language that they, together with many people, built, called it Afrikaans, and called themselves Afrikaners to this continent. And our starting point was to say, we see ourselves as Africans. We know no other home. We're not going to leave. But we also don't live in this country alone. So we want to build a future that where there can be mutual recognition and respect amongst communities, and where there's a prosperous future that is free and fair. In terms of the Afrikaner perspective, you know, if people ask us, who are you, we say you shouldn't be false. We call ourselves an inclusive Afrikaner organization. That would mean that anybody that wants to join can join us. We don't ask any questions on the race, and we have a number of black people, more coloured people, so-called coloured people joining us, but the vast majority of people that join us see themselves as Afrikaners. But then we say, well, these people want to get involved, but we always joke to say AfriForum is not like a man, AfriForum is like a woman. And in that sense, we can do more than one thing at a time.
Multitask.
So we're not ashamed of the fact that we take on issues that are of importance to many Afrikaners. There is a voice needed for that. If you don't have that, you will have a radicalization with issues such as the Boeremag and so forth. And our view is to say, no, let's work within the democratic framework and mobilize people in a democratic, peaceful way to take part in the debate. But if you do that, it does not mean that you live in isolation to the rest of the community. So we also, if you look at our civil rights charter, we want to make sure that there is fairness towards all the people in the country. And we're not going to be false to now take on issues to simply position ourselves. We take the core areas where we work. And in those core areas, we will promote the interests of everybody that would benefit from that. For instance, we say every child should have access to quality education. We believe mother tongue education is important, and we fight for the retention of Afrikaans as a medium of instruction. But then we were approached by a traditional leader in Kandla asking us to support him and his community, because the KwaZulu-Natal Educational Department promised them a school, but they're now reneging on that promise. And at the moment, the first court appearance happened, so we're fighting on behalf of that community for a school.
You've got lots of little fights that you're fighting for,
yes,
communities.
Yes,
and issues.
The Faltain communal, traditional community, we're representing them now against a mining company that has moved their graves without permission. We've assisted the Walmanstal Communal Property Association. But if you go and look at our, at the moment we have 105 community safety structures around the country, neighborhood watch kind of projects that we do have. And in those, you actually try and bind in everybody in a broader community to have a concerted effort against crime.
Okay.
If we fix potholes, last year we fixed 16,000 potholes, you don't say, well, we fix these potholes, now only Afrikaners can drive in this lane.
Sure, yeah.
And if you test water, so
okay.
That is our dual role, to create a better future, of course, for Afrikaners, but for everybody in the country, and that must be based on the principle of mutual recognition and respect.
So, I mean, it's one thing to have a charter, of course. Mm. I know the ANC has a beautiful charter, you know, the Freedom Charter. Living it can be another thing.
Yes.
So now we have a much better president in place. We can talk about that later if we have time. But he often speaks about our people need their own land. And then I sit back and say, I think I support you, Mr. President. You keep talking about our people. Is that Freedom Charter for me as well? Is it for everyone? Is it only for members of the ANC? So it's very easy in the day-to-day fighting politics and trying to balance all the different factions inside your own organization to start losing the vision of your own charter or your own cause. I think the ANC, to a large degree, started losing focus on their cause, and maybe they get back to it now. So you feel you're sticking to that cause, that original purpose of the existence of AfriForum, we're still true to it?
Yes, most definitely. I think what we've realized over the last few months, but it's actually started a few years ago, firstly when former President Zuma, I can thankfully say former, when he said, you know, all the country's problems started when Jan van Riebeek arrived, he actually criminalized a whole community. And in a sense, then you have to start tackling those issues. And the problem is in the country is there's not really room for a nuanced debate. You either have to say the existing narrative that is driven by the ruling party. You have to talk within the parameters of that narrative. And if you dare move out of that, you are being portrayed as something you are not. If you're going to look at all our statements, you know, I accept that many people might disagree with some of the things we do, but if you realistically look at them, they are all in line with the charter that we started off with. But unfortunately, the method is to try and portray you as some kind of racist or extremist organization. But if you ask people, tell me, show me any statement of ours that were racist, show me in terms of what project are we extremist, they're not able to tell you that. And I've seen this in discussions with many ANC leaders. They would know exactly, and if you have a discussion, there would be in a friendly atmosphere, and there's no question of these kind of allegations. But as soon as you get into a public debate, the easiest way, if you are not going to answer to the issues that are raised, is to simply try and silence the person that has an opposite view. And that is where we need to stand strong. If you are going to be demonized for saying something different to the existing narrative, the worst thing you can do is to step back and say, oh, let me rather just keep my mouth shut.
Yeah.
So that is pioneering work that we need to do to broaden the debate, to make sure we can allow various views in our country, and you don't simply have one narrative that everybody slavishly has to follow.
I think, obviously, if the whole of South Africa was listening to this debate, they'd want me to interrupt you and steer it down the line of apartheid wasn't a crime against humanity, your comment made on one of the radio stations. And I want to come from this angle and ask you, a lot has been said and done about that. Okay, well, just said, shall we say. You were in hot water all over South Africa, social media. If I was CBS right now and asked you something or had some conversation with you and you had that moment over again, is there anything you'd say differently? Did you learn something from that specific conversation? I mean, it's under pressure. Mm. It's not your first language.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying your English is bad, but I mean, you know, people forget that you're having tough conversations about tough issues on platforms with very eloquent, sharp, intellectually sharp people. And that certainly happened with that eloquent man in the studio. Would you do anything different when you look back at it now, hindsight, signs of hindsight?
You know, I think one can always rationalize and say, no, I would have done it the same. But I actually thought afterwards, what should I have done differently? And I can sincerely say I would not have done anything different. I would have actually just wanted people to listen to my whole argument. Because the same argument I'm going to give you now, I gave also on Eusebius's show. I also stated it in the things I've written afterwards. But Eusebius elected only to take one sentence and tweet it without saying everything that I said in that whole interview.
And that's the society we live in. It's short tweets, highlights, which people then latch onto, and that stays with us. Forever.
But for the record, I'll tell you exactly what I said. I said I believe apartheid was wrong because it infringed, in the end, with the implementation thereof, it infringed on the dignity of many people, and many people were hurt. And that is my exact words, and that's also the AfriForum position. We don't fight for a better past, we fight for a better future, and we recognized that people's dignity was infringed upon, and we work for a system where the dignity of all are respected. That I said quite clearly in the interview. What I said, I refuse to accept, because you must remember I was in that interview with Professor Adam Habib.
And was very negative about AfriForum.
Yes, well, to just to give you an example, he said he actually compared us with Idi Amin, with Adolf Hitler. And we know what Idi Amin did. We know Adolf Hitler, there were 6 million Jews killed in gas chambers. And what I said there is we're not apartheid denialists or apartheid apologists. What we say is we cannot stand for a situation where apartheid is put in the same category as Nazism and as a crime against humanity. And that still remains my position. And I'll continue to say that. I'm not going to change it because the people that want to abuse what you're saying...
Or heard one little part of it.
Yeah. That is something. And the fact is, if you serious disagrees with me, that's fine. But what's happening, you know, if you listen to CBS's program and many others on a few other activists that are talk radio hosts, and there's a lot of accusations thrown at so-called white people. I don't like that term. I'm an African with a lighter complexion. But they are saying, you know what, you don't want to speak about apartheid. They accuse so-called white people. You are saying, let's just forget the past and move on. And they say, no, we must speak about the past. But then that invitation or accusation is not sincere. Because what I then said on a CBS program, okay, let's speak about it. So they don't, but you see, CBS, he doesn't want me to speak about it. He wants me to simply confirm what his views are. And that is the whole problem with this demonization. Fortunately, if you want to be in the activism space where AfriForum is, you cannot be too sensitive. We always joke to say we're in a boxing ring, and I mean that figuratively, and let me just say that because sometimes the same people, if you say something figuratively, they would actually say, "Wow, so you're in a fist fight." But if you go into a boxing ring and you are fighting for a certain cause, sometimes people would hit you back. That is how it works. So we're not going to cry about this. This is a strategy that's being used against us, but it cannot silence us. It cannot create a situation where we cannot speak about the past. And you know, many business people from the so-called white community or people that see themselves as progressive, they must realize if you're going to say the whole apartheid history was just one crime scene such as Nazi Germany was, it means that everything that was built, even through hard work, in that time, is something that you gained from a crime. And if you look at the asset forfeiture unit, they're going to take money that you got from a crime. So those, even the so-called left white that's throwing stones at me, they must just ask themselves, what the things they have, did I get it through a crime? And then they must give it up. So they can't have the best of both worlds. You have to say there was certain development. People still had to work hard in many instances. And you cannot just say everything was bad.
Because it's so much about words, Kali.
Yeah.
So in other words, you're saying you would not have said it differently. I didn't know the context was that Habib was on the show and that Nazism and other things were already quoted and mentioned on the show. And therefore, you brought that into your answer or into your statement. That does change the context. But in isolation, you'd stand on a platform and say apartheid was not a crime against humanity.
I'll never say it in isolation.
Yeah, there's a context around it.
Because you have to explain to people the problem is if you say it in isolation, people would think you're saying apartheid was the best development since Biltong, and of course it was not. That is the problem. We in our political debates cannot be done through sound bites or sweeping statements. And because that is not so, it doesn't mean I should not have the ability to continue to use the same kind of strategy. We are all in favor of a nuanced debate. tolerance towards varying views. The fact is, we are in favor of improving this country, tackling poverty, fighting crime together with other communities. I've mentioned all those examples. And even if you differ in terms of what terminology should be used, you can still, I think we in this country, we focus too much on those issues that we disagree on. And it will be a relatively small part of the real issues. I think most issues we agree on, and we should be able to work together. But to be able to do that, we need tolerance towards diversity, not only cultural diversity, diversity in terms of views. And that's when we'll move forward. And that's why we're not going to backtrack. We believe we're on the right track.
Going into the next round.
And yes, and of course, anybody can disagree, but at least don't throw the low blows. Fight within the rules of the public discourse.
But Kali, I mean, I have a big problem with our public discourse at the moment. It seems like there's something wrong in our society. Only radical views or statements drive the public discourse and narrative. So when Malema says something radical, and he's a master at that, I think he plans it almost, or maybe it does come out naturally, radical things, and the media love him, and they report on him, and they follow him, and they give him much more coverage than the calm, balanced type leader that tries to do a good job out there. So that's what happened. So you came out in a conversation, there was a snippet that was radical, and that took it into a big discourse and drove the narrative for a while. I mean, I think if we looked at the pie of social media attention, probably took quite a part of that pie in terms of hashtags and things. So that worries me. You know, we have these sound bites, as you say. The only way you can honestly get into the middle of the debate and the discourse is if you say something super radical, and then it pulls you in, and that's risky. Is that a problem, old man? I mean, are we're not in a healthy way going into good debate necessarily. The debate follows radical statements or perceived radical statements.
Kali, appreciate the way you've explained it to us. I think we'll have to live with the fact that the emotionality is not going to go away overnight. But from a leadership point of view, I must admit what we would look for is passionate allegiance to the cause. Now, one advantage of this kind of debate, where so much unreasonable standards are being maintained, which is not right, is the fact that it does refine your thinking and feelings. I mean, 10, 20 years ago, Carly, one didn't really analyze a party in that sense. We didn't analyze the ANC. Remember the old days, etc. Nowadays, this drives one to analyze these things and decide exactly what do I believe in.
You didn't dare analyze Mandela. And then you have Malema come and criticize him, and suddenly people analyze differently.
Yeah. Or there's like your article on racism, which is evoking a lot of response. Now, Kali, so therefore, when one goes through this process and you start maintaining a passion for what you're doing, after you've done a couple of rounds, and I grew up in a boxing environment. My dad was a professional boxer. Jan could box quite well. So I'm saying this is the good thing about it. So you can't enter this debate if you're not prepared to be refined by the pressures around you, not so. And this way, I think you people are going through a process which genuinely is refining you into a convincing, authentic civil rights organization. This is pretty good for the country.
Kali, do you feel like you're fighting an uphill battle because you're white in the current context, or light-skinned, and or some would say on the wrong side of history?
Maybe I can just say I don't have a boxing background. I was born looking like this. So.
Something else happened along the way.
No, I think we. The problem is, I think history plays a very big role in terms of who is seen to be able to say something with credibility. And as soon as somebody that sees himself as an Afrikaner says something, it's immediately being analyzed in terms of history. But there are now two ways you can react to this. You can rather say, and that's unfortunately what many people are doing, is let me just withdraw.
Yeah.
And withdrawal, there's many manifestations of that. You have people now living in Australia, New Zealand, the UK, in the USA, and a number of other places that have said, you know what, this is, we're not going to be able to build a future because we have to stay quiet and do, and just accept everything that happens. That, of course, you would have radical elements on the Julius Malema side that would say, good riddance. We should get rid of those people. They should go back to Europe. That is what many, in terms of the threats that we get in the so-called Black Twitter. But people should realize many of those people that left could have played a huge role in this country, generating investments, creating jobs, uplifting fighting poverty. So that is not for us an option to react in that way. The other option is just to keep quiet and just say, well, let's just take what's happening to us. I always believe you should not be simply a victim of history. You should help to write history. And what you do today writes the history that people would read tomorrow. And through that, you can make an impact. So our view is to say, let's rather participate, play a constructive role, and then just make sure that we don't let the consequences of us participating and people trying to demonize you, not to let it silence you. And in the end, we know that 5 million people, of whom the majority are black people, received clean water after we found in the various places we tested water that it was dangerous, and we acted to make sure it's clean. There we played a prominent role to play a more positive role, and we will continue to do that. We don't need the permission of Julius Malema or Eusebius Mackayser. In very hard times, the only thing you can do is to do what you think is right.
The negative coverage of late, does it not worry you that erodes the good that you're doing?
I think we should not try and create the South African society as one brain that always thinks the same. You know, there's a Winston Churchill had a saying that said we should not confuse published opinion with public opinion. And if you look at some of the Afrikaans media, but also the most English media, you have a handful of people that are controlling the narrative. And their views are sometimes confused with public opinion. And it's not. It's published opinion. What we've seen in the Afrikaans community, in terms of our support, because people are also, we should not underestimate the public's ability to make intelligent choices and to see what's happening. In the past, the media had a monopoly. They were able to dictate what the various labels is. You're either going to be right-wing, left-wing, or they were able to label you as a communist or a liberal.
Yep.
And they even then had the ability, because they had the monopoly, to put people that differed from them in a specific label. They would say, in the past, this person is a communist, or he's a liberal, or he's a right-wing or left-wing. But the brilliant thing about social media is it broke that monopoly. And what we see in terms of the Afrikaans community, the unfair attacks have no effect. No, it has an effect. It makes us stronger. For every one member we lost during these attacks on us, 17 others joined. So that has grown. In terms of the broader community in the country, we are worried. We want to give out the hand of friendship towards the black people, all people in this country. And of course you are worried, what would the Eusebius effect be on the normal black people on grassroots level? But we have actually quite interesting, if I look at in terms of black people, normally you would think people on grassroots level are the radical people, and they become less radicalized the bigger they put or the higher up they are in the elite.
But not.
But it seems it's the other way around.
May have changed over the years.
Yes, and what we experience in this time, our community safety people went to work, for instance, with a community safety initiative in Soweto, and the relations there were good. There was no question about
very
this.
Very interesting.
We find that on grassroots level. So, of course, we don't enjoy the fact that people that don't necessarily have the grassroots support, but they have a monopoly on what is being said. We don't like it if they demonize us. But fortunately, I think people can think for themselves, and there are more than enough people from all communities that would say, let's work for a better future, and those are the people's hands that we are going to take.
I mean, we're running out of time, but I think in many respects what you're saying kind of proves that Malema is right as well. He also talks about a few people driving a narrative.
Yes, and he's one of them.
Yeah, in some way. But he calls it other things. He says white monopoly capital control the media, for example. Or, you know, he's got other ways of saying other things that suits his agenda. But you also had the overseas trip that just, I mean, we don't have enough time to analyze that in detail, but it just sparked incredible reaction when, you know, some would call it a unpatriotic act, and you guys called it a patriotic act.
Yes.
And that's the diversity in our country. Just, you know, I watched that with keen interest. I have a lot of thoughts on my mind, but I watched your colleague Aaron Roots sitting on, I think Tucker is the one guy who's very influential, you know, polished talk show host on TV, eloquent English, saying, making radical statements. And the challenge is, Aaron Roots may sit on the platform and say the right things, but when that guy says the wrong things, then he doesn't necessarily, isn't necessarily that present that he corrects him. So it's that challenging. As if you and I were having a debate here and I'm saying something really radical, and you have the opportunity to correct me, but you just continue with your message, which is fine, you're driving your message. But people don't see that. They don't just see what you're saying. Mm. Is that correct or not? They watch how you react towards the presenter or towards the interviewer. Are you actually correcting this guy when he says there's a full-scale genocide in the country or whatever? So it must have been an interesting learning curve for you guys to be over there on those platforms, driving something genuine and good, I think, but learning key lessons, even micro lessons of those interviews with these people. Just take a minute on that. I mean, what went on there? This big blow up about your trip overseas.
No, maybe if people look at that interview, they would see that Tucker, in the intro, he has a different tie than the one he has during the interview.
Oh, yes.
So the intro was done afterwards. But I'm not criticizing Tucker. The fact is, it seems like in this country we've become so used to the violence and terrible things that are happening that we try to normalize it. If you're going to have attacks on farms, and in terms of the statistics we have, and we can verify every number with names and places, 20% of these attacks is accompanied by torture. People are, electric drill was used the other day to drill a hole into an elderly woman's feet. You had a man that was tortured with a blowtorch.
These are awful.
So those things are. So if a person sitting on the outside sees this and then says this is terrible, we've tried to normalize it. So
We've become numb a bit.
Yes.
Even murder is not on the front page anymore, those sort of things. So what you're saying, let me just understand, this helps me to understand more. is that they state it very radically on their side, but that's how they see it because it hasn't become normal to them, or they're not that numb necessarily. The outside view sees the aggression more than we do, almost.
Yes.
But we've got to, you know.
The problem is that, people try to portray the U.S. visit as radical. What is radical? If you're going to expropriate land without compensation, or at least if the ruling party at their Congress in the past December decides, expropriation without compensation is our policy. That is radical. And why I say it's radical, it's not radical just towards property owners. It's radical towards everybody in this country. Mm. If you look what happened in Venezuela, Cuba, Zimbabwe, we know that's radical. So that is the radicalization. So if we say, okay, this is going to be terrible. We don't want a 90% unemployment rate as we see in Zimbabwe. We need to stop this. And you say, okay, in the past we've had many discussions with the ANC. We've been ignored. So we need some kind of pressure mechanism to make sure that they listen.
Because the ANC says, come back, don't go over there, come talk to us. But
we've talked to them. We talk to them every year. We have regular meetings. And we've had, all we get when we visit them is tea and sympathy. But no real action on core issues. And the fact that they react in this manner, and well, it's too soon to say, but if you look at how confidently President Cyril Ramaphosa, just after their conference, went to the King Goodwill Zelatini and saying, we are going to take land without compensation and give it to our people. And if you listen now, there's a softening in
there's
the
tempering,
stock.
Definitely.
The tempering. So
you may have impacted to some degree.
Of course. Yeah. That's how it works at the moment. There is a... The ANC, then the EFF puts pressure on them. They are moving towards the EFF. You need a counterbalance. And the counterbalance is not going to just give good arguments. Of course you need good arguments, but you need counterbalance pressure. And that is what we've done. And the country should be happy because we want to save the economy from being destroyed.
History will tell to a large degree, wouldn't it? Kali, we can talk about that issue for long, and I'd like to have an open discussion, but our time is up. Just, are we doing enough to create unity in our country?
Yes, I think in terms on grassroots level,
there's more of it there.
We should make sure that we do much more. The first thing you can start off is to respect everybody just in your daily life. If you move around in the country and you speak to people, make sure that through your behavior, you make sure that we build a respect for the dignity of all people. And that is the message towards AfriForum members. It's a message towards everybody in the country. That's where it starts, and we should build from there. And that's also the way to neutralize somebody like Julius Malema that makes polarizing statements. People that want to say we make the same kind of statements, they must just show me where. So that is where we should start. Respect people's dignity. And if you do that, you can also with confidence ask that people also should respect your dignity. And that is what AfriForum does.
Kali Creel, CEO of AfriForum, thank you for joining us. Difficult conversations, and time flies too fast. But you're part of the country's narrative. I believe so much in that principle of counterbalances. I can see that happening. And thank you for trying to make a difference in the country. You know, like so many other leaders, we appreciate your time on the platform. Old man, our time is up. Just want to take a
statement. AfriForum is playing a historic role in giving the Afrikaner a new vision. So the word Afrikaner is actually African. It's remarkable that people have realized that. And I think that role is a vital one to bring back balance in our country. Thank you, Kali.
Thank you for joining us this week's Leadership Masterclass. Look forward to being with you again next week, every Monday, 1 to 2 live on Cliff Central. Cheers, everyone.
This is CliffCentral.com.